Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Talk about the VOD and the silver screen. Kevin and Tom and Joe know all there is to know, from masterpieces to deep fried tacos. And if the movie sucks, you might hear them say, there's no telling where the guys will take you. Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, cause we already warned you. Better watch out.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 783, Dune 2, The Legend of Curly Spice.
Hey, it's as valuable as gold.
Yeah.
Maybe more.
So they say. So we will go around the table and everyone can introduce themselves.
This is Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. Joe is out this week, so you just got the two of us.
All right.
Which I guess makes sense since it's Dune 2.
Yeah, see?
Yeah.
We're like, Joe, you can't be on this show.
Yeah.
It's Dune 2.
Oh, man. If only I couldn't have been on this show. So
this should be an interesting one.
So quick shameless plugs. Don't forget we're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, TuneIn, iHeart. Wherever you find a podcast, you can find us. While you're there, be sure and follow us so you never miss an episode. Maybe leave us a review. Super helpful. Greatly appreciated. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. It's called the League of Show Sharers because we are hoping you will share an episode.
Is that why we did it?
That is why we did it.
Dang,
so people who were kind enough to share an episode last week include Librarian Cynthia, Tammy Lynn Powers, Betts, Phil Timon, Tom Dowdy, Julianne Jordan, Chris Falls, Glenn Cougar, Mellon Brewer, Chris Magic Man, Gabriel Lugo, Richard Kratzer, Ralph Tribble, Travis Tewitt, Heather Sachs, Taylor Ward, David Rojas, Colby Mack, Geek to Me Radio, The Real Pete, Ronnie Castle, Spoiler Piece Theater, In Session Film, Binge Movies, The Film Bee, Nostalgia Cast, Matt Naglia, Ryan Terry, and Mike, and Oscar. So thank you very much. We greatly appreciate it. You can also check out our Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month you get all sorts of bonus content. You help us out, we like you more, and honestly we probably save you that $5 just on drive-away dolls, right?
Like, well, are you talking about the trauma, the therapy?
Yeah, I'm just talking about the ticket price.
Oh,
like, well, if you listen to that before you win.
Well, in the short term, right. I mean, yeah. We save the money, but I mean, long term, think about you.
Absolutely.
You love the Coen brothers? Well, you might think differently now. What if that ruined your whole outlook on the Coen brothers?
You've wasted 30 years of film
your
going.
Entire life.
Yeah. So, is that everything? Oh, our YouTube. Don't forget, you can watch all of these over on YouTube at youtube.com/@ampersandtheclip. Real spoilers
and crystal clear HD.
Oh yeah, because we have fancy new cameras, which is part of what the Patreon money goes to. So yeah.
And we need it because we are at goose egg now.
Yo,
we are reset.
Whoops.
So cameras took every last penny we have. We had a big expenditure last year, and now with the extra equipment. But we're doing this because, you see, the money doesn't go to us, it goes to improving the show. Literally, we put every penny that we make back into the show. Tom, Joe, myself, we don't take any money as a paycheck. Literally, over the years, we just improve our equipment, computer dies, a mic dies, new cameras, that's what it goes to. So seriously, if you love the show, I mean, if you enjoy listening to it at all, $5 a month really does help.
Absolutely. So anyway.
And Denis Villeneuve told us he would beat us up if we did this in less than 4K. So had to, you know.
So anyway, there's all that. I guess let's dig into Dune Part 2.
So what's your experience with Dune? I mean, you grew up at a time where the book was around. You had the 1984 film.
I tried to read the book. It is a snooze. I think the films are very faithful adaptations.
For better or for worse.
They are also snoozes.
That's so interesting.
I get people love this movie.
I love the book, and I love this movie.
And look, I cannot deny that like this is a great-looking movie.
Yeah.
Right? Like
it's Greg Fraser, yeah. The Batman.
Yeah. No, I mean, it looks great. Like, but it's I could not care less about anything I'm looking at. It might as well be, for me, a 165-minute screensaver. Like, don't care at all.
See, what's so interesting to me about that is that, I mean, it's not like you're opposed to sci-fi movies or sci-fi stories, and this is such an inspiration. If you read the books and then you watch Star Wars, which is the order I think most people do it. I mean, I grew up with Star Wars, not Dune, right? And then you read the book, and you're like, oh, that's where he got it from, and that's where he got that from, and that's where, yeah. I mean, these books are like the story, and especially if you look at the prequels and you read the first two books, Dune and Dune Messiah, the prequels and Anakin's story, it's this.
Yeah.
This is what it is. It's the story. I mean, Chani, spoiler alert, but she gives birth to, how many babies do you think she gives birth to?
Two.
A boy and a girl.
Okay.
She dies in childbirth. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the story of Anakin Skywalker, Paul Atreides, you know, Chani, Padme, the twins that grow up. I mean, it's the prophecy. Anakin, you were the chosen one. That's Dune. I mean, you cannot deny that. And I'm sure he doesn't deny it completely at all either. But if you watched this after, you'd be like, oh, this sounds familiar. And it's like,
yeah.
When did he write the book? 1965 or something?
Yeah, I think the first one's 65 and Dune Messiah 69.
So anyway, I'm just saying, if you love Star Wars, this is such an... It's a desert planet, Tatooine, Arrakis.
Yeah.
It's kid grows up on a desert planet. So it's curious to me. I know there's not lightsabers in it, but, you know, there's powers, there's mind powers.
Yeah.
And stuff. How does this completely not work for you?
I think because it's not fun. There's nothing fun in this movie, and I'm not saying every movie has to be fun, but like I just don't care
about that worm riding scene that was done practical.
I mean,
2 months they filmed that one scene for 2 months because it was all done practical with sand. They built a huge set for the worm and the hooks and everything. Like, that scene was not CG, which is just crazy that a filmmaker like Villeneuve would take 2 months to film a 5-minute thing that anyone else would go, oh, put them on a, I mean, look at Star Wars, you know, on a green screen, on a speeder or whatever. Like, I don't know, just the level. I mean, and I'm not saying it's just technically impressive. I enjoy it too, but still, like, if you don't appreciate anything else, the achievement that this film was made.
Like I said, it's a great looking movie. I tried to read the book, and it's just so dense. I just didn't care. And it's a similar problem I had with Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
You know, although I like those movies, but I feel like that worked better on film the way it was adapted. But I just don't care about any of this.
Okay. It's interesting, but fair enough. I mean, at least if nothing else for the podcast, if a listener doesn't care for these books and movies, they got you. If they love them, they got me. So I read the book. I've read the first two books, which is, you know, the first book was split into these part one and part two. And then Villeneuve says that he will make a trilogy if they let him. And so Messiah will be the next one. I'm very curious how.
Well, based on opening weekend box office, they're going to let.
There shouldn't be any doubt, but it's not officially greenlit, but yes, it's as good as done. And he's working on the script and apparently is almost done with it. So I'm really curious how they're going to adapt that though, because there's a lot of intrigue and spying and conspiracies and all that. But as far as action goes, I mean, it's pretty much just set on like imagine if the whole movie took place on the Death Star. I'm not saying it all is, but a lot of it is just like them talking and meetings.
Oh, Lucas really did rip it off. He's like, what if the whole thing was just a congressional hearing?
So, and Dune is very political. And again, and that's what I'm saying, is that Star Wars, like in the prequels, all that political stuff, is a lot of what Dune is. And I don't know why. For some reason, I think the world building to me is more interesting and the political aspirations of these characters because, you know, Phantom Menace, I'm like, pod racing, Duel of the Fates. Like, those are the two reasons to watch episode one. You got the two cool things.
Yeah.
You go to the Senate, the Galactic Senate and all that, and you're like,
nobody cares.
Snooze, right?
Yeah.
But in this, and when you read the books, and there's so much, like, behind the scenes, like, you know, plotting, and I don't know, for some reason, it's really interesting. And these characters, like, the rise and fall of Paul Atreides, to me, is very interesting, because the movies have been misinterpreted, these recent ones, and the book was when it came out too, because everyone's like, yay, Paul, he's the hero.
Right.
And this movie's so different from a Star Wars with Luke, at least, you know, Anakin would be a very close comparison, but most of these movies, Lord of the Rings and Star Wars, it's like, you're following the hero. Here we're following the anti-hero. He does not grow up to be a good guy.
Right.
He is responsible. And again, spoilers, and I kind of, to talk about this, I feel like I kind of have to get into the next book. He's responsible for the deaths of 61 billion people.
Yeah, but they're like space people.
61 billion space people.
Right.
But so he ends up being, like, in the first two movies here, we've got the Emperor, who in this film is played by Christopher Walken, and he's kind of the emperor of all these different planets, and Paul essentially tries to overthrow him, but then take more control of these planets, and he essentially it's mass genocide.
Right.
Not a good guy.
Yeah, no.
So if you leave this movie thinking like, yeah, rah, 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 and like the movie gives you that kind of bait and switch because you're like, well, yeah, we definitely don't like the bad guys that have been set up in this movie. So like, yeah, you want Paul to win, but when you realize what Paul's going to do.
Right.
Maybe the emperor wasn't wiping everybody out. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
Yes, he did come and he killed Paul's family, very bad, you know, and put the Harkonnens in control, which is Batista and Stellan Sarsgaard and Elvis, Austin Butler.
Right.
You know, the Harkonnens are the family that took over Arrakis, had Leto killed and is trying to wipe out the Atreides. Yes, that's very bad, very, very bad. But Paul comes along and, you know, the end of this movie, just to skip ahead, what does he say? He's like, holy war, let's go.
Yeah.
And so this movie is very interesting because you see a character that's very conflicted and has a lot of people in his ear. And throughout this film, he knows he can go one way or another. And he tries to stop it and it carries him in the wrong direction. And I think there's a very interesting character study there that hooks me. And then you have obviously the beautiful landscapes and the worm riding and the humor. I was surprised by the humor too. Javier Bardem in this film, I think he's very funny, you know, with his, you know, that's exactly what the prophet would say.
Yeah, I guess. Like, none of it worked for me.
None of it.
I was so bored. Holy I thought Austin God. Butler was awful.
Oh, wow. And people are talking Oscar buzz for
I thought this. That was the, like, a throwback to mustache twirling. Like, it was so bad. Everything about that performance was so cheesy to me.
That's
like,
so interesting.
It was just like I like a villain that like is, and I get that like you have to check your expectations for grounded in reality, but it was just so, I don't know.
This
and
is
the whole
sci-fi villain, you know,
it's kissing the boots and like it was just like, oh my god, this is so dumb.
All right, well, let's get into the plot of this thing. So basically, they've split Frank Herbert's book into two parts. The first part came out in 2021. As we said, Paul Atreides is played by Timothy Chalamet. He's the main character. They go from their home planet of Caladan, which is lush. It has, you know, plant life and water and ocean and everything. And they are taken to the desert planet of Arrakis. And Leto Atreides was put in control there, but it was all a setup by the Emperor. So this planet, if you haven't seen the first one, watch the first one. But they are the only planet that has access to the Spice Melange. And the Spice Melange puts their brain to a higher level where they can calculate space travel. And because if you're traveling planets and you don't have computers, it's like, how are you going to chart that course? So that's what the Spice does. So it's very valuable. It's also a drug that people take. And the Fremen, the people...
it's like if oil was heroin.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you like dipped your finger into the gas cap and were like, oh, yeah, that's some good stuff. So, and some people might. I mean,
yeah, I was like,
judge,
I think they're out there. I think they're out there. Yeah.
I mean, if they do it with whipped cream cans and paint and Mr. Sketch markers or whatever else.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a setup by the Emperor. The Atreides are one of the noble houses. All the noble houses are basically the government headed by the Emperor. They put Atreides because they're coming into power and they want to take them out. They are a threat to take over the whole thing. And so they wipe out Leto. The Harkonnens are kicked out, supposedly kicked out of Arrakis. They're the ones in control. And they step to the side. They end up doing a coup. They take over, take back control, and they chase Paul and his mother into the desert. Mother, played by Rebecca Ferguson, who's excellent in this. She's the real villain. That's the interesting thing this movie does, is if you just watch part one, you're like, yay Paul, yay Lady Jessica. I mean, terrible things happen. Their family is murdered. They are chased into the desert only to barely escape with their lives. And of course you're rooting for them. Why wouldn't you at that point?
Yeah.
But then Lady Jessica, we find out, is plotting this whole takeover of the people and to use religion to chart this course for her family and her son, especially to become a prophet. And the people, the Fremen, you know, the name is very on the nose, the Freemen.
Right. Not subtle.
Yeah. It's the people that aren't a part of the house, the people that have been chased into the desert to survive. And this planet, desert planet, has basically no water. So they're always trying to conserve it. But they are a very religious people. And so Lady Jessica and the Bene Gesserit, who's the religious cult that she is a part of, they have been implanting in their religion and these prophecies. So the viewer is led to question, is this real? Is this really a prophecy? Or is he just playing into the plans of religion? And so anyway, she takes over and really guides the people and guides him on this course of this religious jihad, is what ultimately it's leading to. And she's the villain of the movie, right? As much as we have bad guys with the Emperor and Baron Harkonnen, who is excellent, Peter Sarsgaard, and Raban is Batista, who was in charge, and then Faye Rafa, I think, is the Austin Butler character. They're bad guys, but the villain, the one that's really plotting everything, is Lady Jessica. And I think Rebecca Ferguson does a really good turn of, you know, from part one being the innocent mother who's trying to protect her son to this person who's trying to essentially destroy humanity, you know.
And I think it's like, if you watch any segment of a story or someone's life, not everyone is bad in every, you know, like,
yeah.
If you're only talking about 9/11, then Rudy Giuliani comes off okay.
Right.
Right. And so, but if you zoom out and tell more of that story,
right,
he gets less and less okay as sure. The story progresses.
So it's really interesting to see that. I think that's why the story is so interesting, and especially the way he split it into these two films, because things completely change, but you can't have one without the other. Like this movie, and why, I mean, I think it has a 98% on Rotten Tomatoes critic, a 97 or 99% audience. Like this movie is universally, except for Tom, beloved. And, but the reason why I think this one is doing so well, and the first one was good, but came out during COVID. I believe HBO Max did the day and date thing. So the box office, like this has already doubled the box office, yeah, of the first one. So it came out at kind of a weird time. And also the first part is all set up. This movie is the payoff. And yeah. So it's not that the first one wasn't good, but we all had to hold our breath for 2.5 years because we're like, well, if it doesn't pay off,
right,
the first one was a bunch of setup that went nowhere, right? So the first one now retroactively, and not that it wasn't always good, but together, the first one's so good because they set everything up that pays off so well with the characters and the character arc with Paul Atreides and you know, all the other characters. Chani, Zendaya is very good in this movie. I think everyone's good in this movie. I don't know. It didn't ever strike me as cheesy or anything. Like, I get what you're saying, but have you watched the 1984 David Lynch version where Sting is Fade Rafa?
No, because that looked boring as all get out. And then it came out and flopped hard. It was only in theaters for like 2 weeks or something. Okay. So,
I mean, props to him. I mean, this book, you know, when they say like this is the unadaptable book, like,
yeah,
in general, right? Like, yeah, this is one of those. This is one of those.
Yeah, that, for sure.
To do this insane that he's been able to pull this off, because it's just so good. It's so well done. And again, credit to David Lynch for, I don't want to say trying. I mean, he did it. It's just that obviously it's critically panned. It's not great, right? And at the time, it's like, you know, props for doing what he did,
right,
but now
the studios are much more willing to entertain the notion of, like, what if we made 10 of these movies.
Right.
Where, like, back then...
He had to cram it all into one.
Yeah, there was no let's make 10 of these movies. It was like, maybe you'd get three.
Yeah.
Maybe. And, I mean, the only thing that you would get 10 or more of was James Bond. That was it. Or crappy horror movies.
Right. There was no planning. It's if the movie made enough money, of course they'll greenlight a sequel. We want more money.
But everything needs to ultimately stand on its own. Like, you can't tell half a story.
Exactly. So
that's why it's called the good old days.
Well, that may be one reason.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. So he had to cram this huge book. Like, the first book, I believe, is the longest. It's a very long read. He crammed that into one book on a 1984 budget when superhero movies weren't a thing and movies didn't have $250 million budgets. And then this movie got to be split into two huge movies. And so Villeneuve was able to do it right, in my opinion. He was able to build up the characters, set the story. I mean, you have so much backstory here where you make a new Star Wars movie, everyone gets it. It's just universal language, right?
Right.
Like, new Star Wars movie, even if it's set somewhere a little different at a different time, everyone knows the world.
Yeah, right? You know that the toolbox you're using.
Exactly. And so with this world, we have to learn about the royal houses and the emperor and the planets and all these different, and spice and how that works and everything. So this one picks up right where the other one leaves off. And so the difference is in the book.
There was an Onion headline that said Dune 2 picks up right where you fell asleep in Dune 1. And I was like, for me, it does.
That is
absolutely.
Hey, credit where credit's due. Yeah. That's a funny joke. I did not fall asleep in that one. It picks up right where it leaves off. And in the book, Paul is with the Fremen for 2 years. So that is a big difference. A couple other differences. Paul and Chani, who it's Frank Herbert pronounced it Chaney, is you know, he wrote the book. That's how he said it.
Yeah.
In the movie and miniseries and in these movies, they call her Chani, so we'll just say Chani. But
I wish they would have said Chaney, because it sounds like they're saying Johnny.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah, like Carson. And I'm just like, what?
Yeah, so it's supposed to be Chaney. For whatever reason, they everyone else has turned it to Chani. But
probably because of Dick Cheney.
Yeah, that's probably why, yeah. But a couple other differences. Paul and Chani have a child named Leto, after Duke Leto, the Oscar Isaac character in the first one, Paul's dad. So
oh, not after Jared?
No, this is Leto. That's the difference. Not Leto. Leto. Leto Atreides. So they have a child. Now, the reason why they don't have a child in this movie, one, it's there's a lot of characters. There's a lot going on. I get it. Cut characters.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, spoilers, by the end of the first book, child dies. So to introduce a child and then to kill the baby,
yeah,
it's just...
Although I wish they had, because one, who doesn't like a good child death in a movie, but also
motivation.
I feel like it at the end where he like goes with like, I'll marry your daughter, and she seems all betrayed. I'm like, he kissed you once, like, you need to dial it down. Like, I didn't really get that they were like this great love.
I've heard some people say that. In the book, they're together for 2 years and have a child. So I do get where that would have spoken that a little better. But when I talk to people, and Matt Reedy's one, and I do have a couple complaints from him, but I get that that doesn't really set the stage. But we're talking about a six-hour movie here. I mean, this movie is literally Dune Part 2. It's not like a clever title or whatever. Like, this movie together is one film.
Is one movie,
And it literally picks up at part two. It's not even Emperor Strikes Back. It's part one and part two.
But I still wish they could have done something to convey that this was a... Like, I felt like the relationship was still forming, and she's over there like, what? You're doing what? Like,
There's spoken promises. He says that he'll only love her. I mean, obviously, they have that moment on the top of the dune from Dune. That's the dune.
Yeah.
It is a titular dune, I mean.
Oh. If I had seen her titulars, then I would have known that they were doing much better.
See? Well, they got to conserve water. They're in the water suits. They can't take those off exactly. There must just be like a little hole, a little door you open up. But they're betrothed. I mean, but in the book, they're together for 2 years. They have a baby. So obviously it's a little bit, you can tell that the relationship's a little longer, but he didn't want to, you know, stop the pacing. He didn't want to say, oh, 2 years later, all that. I mean, the movie just picks up and goes. The other difference is, too, in this movie,
they should have done like an Arrakis calendar
flipping this. Yeah. We can see all the different months. And
yeah.
Wouldn't it be funny if there was like Harkonnens like spread out like Burt Reynolds by the fire on a bearskin rug. And, you know, they've got all the models for the calendar. The Emperor Christopher Walken's doing his dance from Weapon of Choice. I mean, come on. That's it. What a great setup for like 20-something years. I mean, that song Weapon of Choice basically has lyrics about Dune. And Christopher Walken's doing the sand walk.
Oh, does it? I never paid
attention
to the lyrics.
Yeah, the lyrics are
song.
About Dune.
Oh, that's
and Christopher
funny.
Walken, he's the emperor. Like, what a great set. Like,
that's funny.
That has to lead to why he was cast. I'm not saying he's not great and, like, you wouldn't want to cast Christopher Walken, but, I mean, the fact that the Fatboy Slim music video.
Yeah.
It's just, what a great tie-in. But anyway, but the other difference, too, is if you remember from the first one, and if you remember from when you just saw this movie, Lady Jessica is pregnant with Paul's sister, and in this movie, she's a fetus. But in the book, she is almost three, and then we learn that she...
Because that's how long it took to read.
But in this movie, we only get a glimpse of the character Alia, who is played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who obviously, kind of cool they cast a big person because the plans are grander, and obviously...
Well, they did this with Zendaya in the last one, right? Like,
yeah, she
like,
was in it at the very end.
She was in it for just a minute, but she was in the trailers a lot, and people were like, what?
Yeah.
What? I thought she was in this movie.
Right.
Yeah.
So Anya Taylor-Joy is going to play Paul's sister, Alia, and in the book, she ends up being kind of pivotal to the plot. She ends up doing something that Paul does that we'll get into later, but she's a 2-year-old, almost three, that walks around and talks like an adult. So I do think that comes off a little weird, and I'm kind of like, I'm glad they just skipped over that.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't need it. Lady Jessica can communicate with her, and Paul asks like what she's saying, so they do have that communication power, so we can understand her thoughts without a little baby walk, because then it would be like ADR, like you can't get a 2-year-old that can
right.
really talk like an adult. That's too young. So I think that it would have looked weird. I'm not saying impossible. I mean, and this guy can do a lot, so maybe it would have been fine, but I'm kind
of
glad.
Lots of shots of the back of her head with voice overs.
Yeah, but it's like, we don't need that, right? Because
yeah.
that's another character, another whatever. And so they gave some of her parts to Paul, like the important part at the end of the movie. They're out in the desert, and essentially what they're trying to do is Paul is trying to get revenge for his family and take things back from the Harkonnens. So Paul is known as the Lisan al Gaib, and that is the prophet. And that's what the Bene Gesserit, Jessica's people, have been setting up, that he is the prophet that's going to save the people, and he's going to turn Arrakis back into this lush paradise with water and everything. So that's the religious context of all this. So Paul gets these visions of water, and he actually sees his sister, the one scene when you see Anya Taylor-Joy, and you know, we know that at some point it's going to be like that. So this desert planet once had water, and all that's been taken away because of the politics and people trying to mine the spice, and they want to keep it a barren wasteland because the spice, I think it's like the sandworms digest stuff and like turn it like spices their output.
It's their excrement.
I think it is. Ecosystem depends on sandworms and spice, and obviously the rich people and the emperor. Spice,
worm poop.
And so the movie starts off saying he who controls the spice controls the people, or spice is power, basically,
yeah.
right? Spice Girls taught us that. And
Spice Channel.
Oh, there you go. Power. Yeah. That is power. So the whole ecosystem for the rich and the powerful and control is based on spice. And what Paul and the Fremen want to do is to regain control of the planet and give their people water, because the winds will kill you, the lack of water will kill you, the heat will kill you, the sandworms will eat you. Like, the planet as it is, they don't need all that. It's bad for business for them. So they're trying to take back control, and Paul is the one supposedly that's going to do this. But again, the Bene Gesserit, and Charlotte Rampling is the Reverend Mother of the Bene Gesserit. She's the one that trained Jessica, and she's also training Florence Pugh. Again, another character, the daughter of the Emperor, and going to be betrothed to Paul before it's all said and done. So they have planted, and there's actually going to be, I know you're excited for this, there's going to be a miniseries on HBO Max.
How exciting.
About 10,000 years ago with their time, about how...
Oh, I love when shows are not about the show you're watching.
But it's about the Bene Gesserit coming to... the planet and implanting the false pro- not false prophet, but what they, who they say is the prophet. So you're going to see why the people believe in this prophecy and everything. So this has been planted for 10,000 years. And so now, of course, all the people are like, Al-Ghaib, like this is our savior right here. Paul, again, has in the book, it's 2 years. In this book, it's kind of instantaneously, but he's accepted into the tribe and he's like, I want to be a Fremen. I want to be part of these people. And this prophecy is putting everything on him that he has to save them. And Shani is mad about this because she's like, it should be a Fremen. It should be one of us that saves us. Like, she's basically saying he's no prophet. This movie, I don't know if you've seen, is getting some crap for being a white savior movie.
Yeah, I mean,
this book is anti-white savior.
Yeah, they just haven't got there yet.
Yeah.
But I get if you don't know the story, and like, most people have not read this book. It's dense. And
but the clues are in this movie. You're not like Shani. In the very first movie, I think it's, but I didn't rewatch the first one recently. I think the movie opens with her going, who's going to enslave us next? And then it cuts to Paul Atreides.
Yeah.
It's like the, he's not subtle about it. Literally, right. If you pay attention, if you're not just someone that doesn't watch the movie and then goes, that's a white savior. But like, you know what I mean? People just like to complain and don't actually watch the thing.
Right.
Like the clues are there. And then people are like, oh, Lady Jessica is cultural appropriation. She's wearing this and putting this stuff in her face. And it's like, yeah, she's bad.
Yeah.
We're not trying to say that, yes, the white savior should come and then culturally appropriate and control the people.
It doesn't help, though, that like it's also very like Middle Eastern, right?
Yeah, for
like,
sure.
You know, like it's you know, it's not subtle in that regard. Yeah. So it does it's hard not to be like, what are we doing?
Yeah. But that's like that's the point of the original text is that you should not clearly have a white savior come and take over and then have religion guide people. This whole movie is an allegory about religion, using religion for control.
Yeah.
Like that is what the movie's trying to
say.
No,
there are definitely a segment of the population that could really use a story where they get bait and switched and they fall in love with a hero and then it turns out their hero is a piece of There are a lot of people in our society who need to learn that lesson. That is true.
It's a very important. So the film is not subtle.
Can they learn it before November?
Well, you would like to think so, but there's been plenty of time. We'll see how the box office does. Maybe that will correlate, right?
I think we need the third one out before November.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, when you read the third one, and he talks about other genocidal maniacs, he goes through a list of a couple of big ones, and he's like, they killed 4 million. Yeah, well, because later in the book, he talks to Stilgar, the Javier Bardem character, and Javier Bardem's a soldier, essentially, and he's like, I don't need to know history. And he's like, you need to know the history of Earth. So-and-so wiped out 4 million people. Other bad guy wiped out 6 million people. You can probably guess who it was. And he's like, I wiped out 61 billion people. And then, you know, Stilgar goes, that's because you are the man. Like, wow, you are awesome. And Paul's like, maybe what I'm doing isn't right. Like, Paul is conflicted. He's never like, I'm so proud of doing this. Yeah. He doesn't want to go on this path, and he's done it, so I'm not saying that he's not responsible at all, but, like, you can clearly see from this movie, like, he doesn't want to go take over and kill everyone, but all these decisions and the religious control and all that leads him there, and he's, the whole next book, like, he's not having a great time. He's not happy with his life, the direction it's going, the future. He's the whole time in this movie, it flashes back and forth, and he's like, I can't go south, because if I go south, I've seen the visions, I become the leader, and then we go to, you know, the religious war. And he eventually is driven that way, but he doesn't want to. But where he ends up, he ends up doing some terrible things.
I guess the takeaway is that as long as you don't want to kill 61 billion people, it's okay if you do.
Not okay, and that is the point. But he's not, I'm just saying, like, he is not a dictator in the way where he's just like, I want to do, like, he goes down a bad path. You know, he was the chosen one, and unfortunately he was chosen for the wrong purpose, and he's being manipulated by the real villain of the story, Lady Jessica, his mother. And in the book, I don't think they say it in this one, if you remember, but the book, he's like, she is my enemy. Like, in the book, he calls her out. He's like, I see what she's doing, and I'm having trouble stopping all this from motion, but she's like, my mother is my enemy. So he, you know, it's right there on Front Street. I think the movie tries to kind of lead you along a little bit more, but Paul is very aware of these things that's going on. Meanwhile, Baron Harkonnen is not happy with his one nephew, Raban, who is Batista, who's, you know, they're losing all their spice harvesting equipment. So the Fremen during
the spice channel has been scrambled.
It has. It's scrambled. The box isn't working anymore. They're hitting it. Nothing's working. basically, for half of this movie, it's Paul and the Fremen going around and using weapons to destroy the bad guys, the Emperor's army, and the spice harvesting tools. And so they're blowing up these things. There's a really good action sequence where the Paul and Chani are like going in between the legs of the spice harvester, where it's running around with its big, you know, big grindy things, and they're having to like hide behind things because they're in the helicopters and they're trying to shoot at them. So it's kind of an exciting action sequence. And when he loads her weapon, like, he distracts the, they call it a thropter, I think is the name of in the universe, but he distracts the thropter, and then the gunner from the thropter looks over at her and she's already shot a grenade up into it and it explodes. So really cool scene there. They're reunited with the Josh Brolin character from the first movie, who we weren't sure if he is dead or not. Come to find out, he has been kind of hiding on the planet until he can exact his revenge. He's with the spice smugglers. So there are a group of smugglers that go behind the Harkonnen's back and, you know, try to get spice from themselves, and like a Han Solo type, we would say.
Okay.
He ends up joining forces with the Fremen and Paul. And so my point was that Baron Harkonnen is not happy with Raban because he is not stopping the Fremen. He's failing. They're losing men. They're losing weapons. And so he goes over to his other nephew, who is the Elvis character. The Austin Butler plays Fade Rotha. Okay, I got that right. I'm like trying to keep these names straight.
It's a big universe.
So Fade Rotha is his youngest nephew, and he's a psychopath. He's a killer. He's crazy. He's one of those, you know, he's licking his knives, and I know that you weren't digging what he was doing, but he's chewing the scenery. But you know, the character is supposed to be this crazy killer. It was Sting running around in his underwear, like in a loincloth with no shirt on, just being, you know, that was his 1984 portrayal, was this wacko just making faces and running around half naked. And so anyway, this portrayal I think is a lot better. It's more sadistic. I think he seems like a killer and a madman, and I think he does a really good job with it. But they go to their home planet, and Villeneuve and Fraser, they decided to film this with infrared cameras. So the planet is very desolate and very bleak. I'm trying to think of the name. I'm just Geti Prime is the name of the planet where the Harkonnens came from, their home planet. And they filmed.
Oh, it's frustrating because Geti Prime is now charging $3 a month if you don't want commercials.
Oh.
Yeah.
So and that's the last thing you probably want. You're like, skip.
Oh, it's nice to have a commercial. Brief reprieve.
Oh, is that right? You like the commercials in this Dune one? So. So like it goes to this very bleak black and white look, and they use these infrared cameras to film the entire thing because this planet is just, you know, it's supposed to look dangerous and barren and everything. So all the sequences on Geti Prime are filmed in this very high contrast black and white. It's beautifully, I mean, the whole film is gorgeous, like you said, if nothing else. And I've got a lot of else, but if nothing else,
no, it's great,
it's a
looking
beautiful looking, it's great movie looking. So they film this thing, and so what they do to, I guess, to celebrate their birthday or whatever celebrations the Harkonnens do,
is you get to kill somebody.
You get to kill three people in this case. So
except if it's a milestone birthday.
That's true. He is,
it's like this, 30, 40, you get to kill. Yeah,
I think he's turning 17. So
he's supposed to be 17.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, is this Grease?
They're aliens. Well, the deleted scene was when he sings about greased lightning. So it's pretty exciting. I don't know, but I think it's 17. So he's supposed to be the same age as Paul. And did you, I think they, oh, okay. So it's different from the book. But in this movie, did you catch that Fade Rautha was supposed to be the chosen one?
Which one's that?
I think Austin Butler, the guy we're talking about.
Okay.
Fade Rotha was supposed to be the Kizat Haderach, which is the superior being that the Bene Gesserit have been breeding and trying to find the strongest houses. And so Paul was supposed to be a female child of Leto and Jessica. And the Reverend Mother says that she disobeyed them because the Bene Gesserit have control of their body and mind and everything. And Leto wanted a son. So Jessica, not his wife, his concubine, because for political purposes, he never married her, but he loved her like his wife. It's just one of those heartbreaking things.
Why bring paper into this baby?
Yeah. Look at Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn.
We don't need the government in our love.
But look, Hollywood relationships that have lasted. Kurt Russell, Goldie Hawn, not married. Look at that. So she disobeys the Bene Gesserit and gives him Paul as a male heir to the Atreides, but the Bene Gesserit were supposed to have... House Atreides was supposed to have a daughter, and then Fade Rafa Harkonnen was supposed to marry the Atreides' daughter, and that was supposed to create the ultimate bloodline. You have the Harkonnens,
and then
the Atreides.
You get the knick-knack paddywhack.
Exactly. Gotcha. Give the dog a bone. So that's what happens. So she betrayed them. So, you know, I mean, it is 21,000 years later. You would think that they could still get married, but I guess in this...
Talk about playing the long game.
Right?
I just don't see the benefit of, like, I'm setting this thing in the motion so in 10,000 years... my offspring can, like...
Well, it's selective breeding. Like, they have to... It's not like they just want someone that's, like, okay. Like, they're at the point where the bloodlines will be pure enough and powerful enough with their, you know, their powers that they have and everything, that by the time they get to Fade Ralpha, he's supposed to be the most powerful and you know, best fighter and a mentat and all this stuff. And then the daughter of the Atreides, like they're the
but
most.
But none of these people really seem like they have the patience to wait that long.
No, that's very true. Well, and I think everyone has their own thing going on, right? Like Baron Harkonnen is just wants to be rich and fat and kill his slaves. And like he's good with his control of the planet and spice. Yeah. And like everyone's kind of got their own thing going on, but the Bene Gesserit are the ones pulling the strings. So I don't think Baron Harkonnen necessarily is like, Fade Ralpha has to be in control. He's basically like, when I die, who do I give this to? Oh, Fade Ralpha seems like the only competent one. But Bene Gesserit are like, no, Fade Ralpha is going to rule the universe. So anyway, so in this movie, Fade Ralpha is supposed to be the Kizat Haderach. And Paul ends up being the one that through like, they didn't want him to be, but he passed the Gamjabar in the beginning of the first movie. He ends up being able to drink the water of life, which we find out is secreted from the, like a mini sandworm. Like the sandworms are kind of seen in this religious, I can't remember the religious name for them, but give me a pass on this one. But they are kind of, you know, seen as these amazing creatures, and the Fremen ride them and tame them. And we find out the way they get the water of life is they take a young one, which is, you know, it's probably like 2 feet long in a pool. Once it gets to be that age, it has the purest poison. And that poison is what the Reverend Mothers drink to get the knowledge of the past Reverend Mothers during this ritual and all that. But it kills any male. No male has ever taken the water of life and survived, ever. But because of Paul's powers and from the Lady Jessica and all of, and, you know, that bloodline, and because now the Fremen see him as, you know, the chosen one and the prophet and everything, he is able to take that. So obviously he has these powers that the Bene Gesserit didn't even predict. In the book, it is, you remember Leia Sado, who was on the Geti Prime? She's the one that lured Fey Ralpha to sleep with him. Bene Gesserit said, we need a male Harkonnen. We need to continue that bloodline if something happens to these guys. So she sleeps with.
Okay.
She seduces him. Like, she's like, I'm going back to my room, and he shows up. And
was that in this one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was in black and white, yeah.
I got nothing.
Okay. So Leia Sado, she's been in a lot of stuff. She was in the last Bond, I think. She was in a game called Death Stranding, did the motion capture, and is really good. But anyway, she's been in a bunch of stuff. You'd know her if you put the name with the face. But the Bene Gesserit sent her. She's Fenring, Lady Fenring. And she, in the book, her husband, he's like the best friend and the right-hand man of the Emperor. Something happened to her. He became a eunuch. And he was supposed to be the Kizat Haderach. And because of him becoming a eunuch and he lost some of his abilities with these experiments.
Yeah, you're going to lose an ability.
Right? So something happened to where he couldn't do it, but he was the one they were grooming. So they decided to, again, cut that character, not really important. You have Lady Fenring, get rid of the male Fenring, and they made... I thought that was a cool plot point that there was a Harkonnen Kizat Haderach, and there was the Atreides one, and then they show down in the end. I think it made more of a like a movie climactic showdown. Like, these are the two chosen ones that battle it out, rather than here's just a crazy Baron's nephew battling it.
Yeah,
it made it more impactful. Like, it's either him or him.
The stakes are higher.
Exactly, the stakes are higher. We find out he impregnates Lady Fenring, so that if the Atreides and the other Harkonnens die out in this war, there's a baby, and the bloodline of the powerful Harkonnen bloodline should continue on. So it doesn't come up in Messiah, so I'm not really sure what happens. I'm sure later on when I'm sure his kids will end up facing off against the, like, you know, they plant that seed literally and figuratively, and then, you know, it surely pays off in the six books that Frank Herbert wrote. And then his son and Kevin Anderson, is it Brian Herbert and Kevin Anderson? They continue it on for like 10 more books or something. I think they're still going. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's a bunch.
There's a bunch. But anyway, in the six books, I mean, you know, call me a keys at Hatterack, but I'm predicting this is going to pay off down the road. They're taking out all the spice production. They're taking out all the Emperor's men and the Harkonnens, and eventually, oh, and the Emperor thinks that Paul's dead. Like, you know, they were supposed to be sent out to the desert and killed, but now there's Mo Adib, who is, you know, taking out all their men and foiling them. And, you know, the Emperor is like, who is this Mo Adib? And his daughter, Aurelian, played by Florence Pugh, is like, what if, you know, what if Paul's still alive? And he's like, that's crazy. There's no way he could be alive. And Aurelian's like, okay. Like, it's him. Like, it's probably him. So Mo Adib ends up sending a communication to the Emperor and is basically like, yeah, we're taking over. You need to come down here if you want to stop us, but we're coming for you and we're taking over everything. And so the Emperor and all his forces end up coming to the planet. And I'm trying to think in between there. Oh, Paul rides a sandworm, which is the big like rite of passage. He sleeps with Chani. Again, there's no child.
Yeah, don't do it the other way around.
No.
Yeah, that's ill-advised.
Yeah.
No matter how enticing that popcorn bucket looks.
Yes. Yes, definitely. So, you know, so I'm trying to, so, you know, they're a couple, and meanwhile, he's having these nightmares, which we know are what would you call visions? You know, they're essentially his powers. He's able to see past, present, future. But what's interesting, I think, is that the prediction.
I don't think being able to see the present is much of a power.
Well, like what's going on?
We can all see the present.
No. Like, you know, if someone's plotting something 10 miles away and you got to go stop them, like you kind of know what they're up to. He can see things going on elsewhere for, you know, coordination purposes. But what's interesting is that he has these visions, but they're not 100%. And throughout this whole film, Paul is trying to change his...
Well, that's just called a hunch.
They pay off. They're just the details are a little blurry.
If your vision is not right, then spoiler, you're not having visions.
No,
just... That's called a psychotic break.
No, he can see what's going to happen. But so he sees in the film, throughout the film, in his visions, he sees this woman that and death all around her, and he's following this woman. But the woman could be Chani, the woman could be the Lady Jessica, the woman could be Aurelian, and we're not quite sure. And I think it's changing as things go on, and as Jessica is taking over and becoming a Reverend Mother and controlling people through religion, she goes to the South, and there's these huge armies and followers that she ends up roping into their plans. And I think his visions are changing. It's becoming more clear it's her, but it could change at any time. But what he sees happens, it's just, you know, the details are in motion. They're moving, right? Like the puzzle pieces are interchangeable at times. So he's seeing all these, you know, visions, and he knows that eventually he's very bad things are going to happen. Josh Brolin, we'll just say, his character says that I have the arsenal. Like when we came to the planet, we brought the Duke's nuclear arsenal and we hit it, you know, just for if we ever needed any weaponry, and we're able to use that. And Paul ends up saying, well, instead of attacking the Harkonnens or just destroying a base or destroying this city, you know, they can always bring more people. But if we destroy the spice, like that's what everyone's after. No one's gonna bat an eye, and that's how he ends up getting the Emperor to come, because he's like, I'm going to destroy all the spice. There will be no interplanetary travel, there will be no drugs for control, no, you know, religious ceremonies that use it. Like this planet is the only one that Arrakis is the only planet in the known universe that has the sandworms and has the spice melange. So he threatens that.
She's like, if I invent an EV car, we don't need oil anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Which isn't true.
Well, that's true. There's a lot of things that depend on it. Yeah. Right. So spice is used for a lot of stuff. So he threatens that. So the Emperor comes with his forces, the Sadakar is the name of the forces. So much stuff to remember, especially when you're the only one remembering terms.
Yeah, I can't help
so,
you.
So, you know, if I'm
glad the main character's named Paul or Jessica. I would have no input of any kind.
Paul, Jessica.
Yeah.
So the Sadakar are the Emperor's forces that he's given to the Harkonnens, and we see them in the first one and how badass they are. Well, the Fremen are able to fight in the desert. They're not used to the sunlight. They're not used to the heat. And so you get some really good action scenes throughout the entire movie where the Fremen are like, you know, they're sliding under their legs and slicing their Achilles' heels and, you know, stabbing them in the back of the neck. And I think those shields they use, I think we find out that, like, where they generate, you have to get them in the neck. That's the only place that you can get through the shield. So, you know, they're...
like Smaug.
Exactly. So you stab them in the neck and they're going around and just, you know, they're very acrobatic. And the guy that fights Fade Ralpha in the Colosseum, we'll call it, yeah, I think we mentioned he kills three people. Well, one guy... That's...
So they have all this technology.
Yeah.
But no Jumbotron. I mean, that place seats like 100,000 people.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, a Jumbotron maybe? Just a thought.
Maybe that runs on computers, though. There's no computers.
I mean, we had TVs before computers. I assure you, the television I grew up watching in the 70s did not use a computer.
That's fair, yeah. CRTs, I guess it is just
image. It's tubes. That's why they called it the tube.
No, right, but I was thinking like for the image, like how do they tune it in? Like I just figured there was some kind of a...
If you can get a spaceship to space...
Then you can get a TV.
Then you can get it. You could come up with a Jumbotron.
I do think that this was very gladiatorial. It was very like having a TV would have been kind of weird. Like it was the Colosseum, you know.
I just, the event promoter in me is like, this is
for
bad.
Sure. I see what you're saying.
And then I'm just like, where are they parking?
But you get TV and they're
lazy.
Imagine
post event traffic on an event like that.
Wow, you can tell you're checked out when you're thinking about the planning for the event. So he kills three people. It's a very ceremonial fight that he does on Getty Prime for this coming of age thing. All the
it's just like every seat was bad, right? Like venues always like to be like, no bad seat in the house, where they're like, all the seats are awful. Like, you don't have to worry about what seat you buy because every seat is awful. Like, the head guy, I know he's not the emperor, but, like, what we would call an emperor if
Baron
this movie
Harkonnen.
Didn't already have an emperor, he's got, like, the worst seat in the whole place. He's sitting at the very top, all the way in the back.
Yeah.
I'm just like, why would you do that?
I guess if you have spice, you know,
Jay-Z goes to a Lakers game, he's sitting courtside.
Yeah, but think about back in the day with kings and when they were fighting going on, they were always up in a tower looking down at the... That's just...
I don't know. There's a movie show us. I don't know that I believe it.
No, I saw the photographs from back then. They were up there.
It's just like, these seats are awful. This is just poorly designed.
Yeah.
It's just not efficient.
Well, but hey, I'm...
Whoever designed this Colosseum, I'll tell you something, that guy needs like 10% more spice snorting in his life.
So during that event, the gladiators that he's fighting are supposed to all be drugged. Well, one of them isn't, and so it gives him a challenge. But the Baron's like, well, if this guy's going to take over my whole operation, I got to know he can fight guys without them being drugged. Like, this guy's got to actually be able to prove himself. And so we see how badass this guy actually is that he turns his shield off, he fights the guy, and this guy that he fights, and I don't have his name, I apologize, he's the fight choreographer for the films. So it's kind of cool that he gets to be a character in the movie that he fights.
I believe his name is Steve.
Oh, is it Steve?
Yeah.
The fight choreographer? Well, for your sake, for remembering purposes.
We're going to call him Steve.
Steve the fight choreographer.
It is weird how it's like everybody's got like, you know... Knick-knack, paddywhack, and Al-Mustan, and then it's
the
like...
The Emperor Shaddam.
And then Paul.
Gurney. Gurney Halleck is the Josh Brolin character.
Do you think he called him... So here's what I think happened.
Yeah.
I think Frank Herbert knew he'd be having to type the word Paul a lot. And he didn't want to give him some weird name that had an apostrophe in it or something. Like, he was just like, you know what? I'm just going to call the dude Paul. It's just laziness on Frank Herbert's part.
You know what? He has a lot of dialogue, or what would I say? You know, like the glossary for Dune is just out of this world.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of Middle Eastern terminology, and I believe he tried his best to use the real words, and some of the stuff, they're pronounced a little bit differently, but maybe he changed them on purpose as to not irritate anyone or something. But
I don't think. It's the mid-1960s.
You don't care.
Nobody cared about that.
But he uses a lot of Middle Eastern words, and they're, you know, true to to the language, and a lot of the ceremonial things, and obviously the outfits. There's a lot of inspiration from that. But anyway, so
I'll tell you this: as someone who has an apostrophe in their name, giant pain in the ass.
There you go.
Frank Herbert made the right call.
So so the emperor comes down with you know, the rest of his armies. He has like five legions of his men, and there's a big showdown. Paul, you know, his forces flank from another side. Like they bomb the desert, and there's like stones and stuff falling in all the soldiers. Meanwhile, they come in from the other side. They take out a bunch of their forces. They essentially storm the castle, kill everybody. We're left with the Baron Harkonnen, Fade Ralphas out there in the periphery, the Emperor, and Princess Irulan. I might have called her Irulan. It's Irulan as the Florence Pugh character. But anyway, they're left with the big players here. Paul walks in as Maudib, and they don't like officially know who he is, but Irulan is like, yeah, that's Paul, like I said. But he walks in and he's all covered, and you know, you can't see who he is, but you know, he walks in a very badass, you know, way, and goes right up to Harkonnen. Meanwhile, I think didn't one of the emperor's guards or someone cut his, like, Baron Harkonnen, the big guy, has this assistive suspender type thing that kind of hold him up because he's so big. And we find out in the books that he has a medical condition. I think it has to do with
thyroid. It's just thyroid.
I'm not even going to try the thyroid condition. But I think what happens is he tries to force himself upon a reverend mother, and they're like, yeah, no, that's not going to fly. And they poison him, so he gets this medical condition. Like, seriously, like, they're just like, no. And someone cuts his suspenders because he says some or fails or whatever he does, but they cut his the suspenders. And so he's like crawling up the throne. And this is a scene where the 2 or 3 year old Paul's sister,
the little girl,
comes up and
if
says,
she had been around.
Yes, she would come up and say, you know, hello, grandfather, or whatever, and kills him. Well, okay, in the book, she pricks him with a poison needle, so it's not quite as dramatic as a knife. But in this one, since they, you know, we're saving her for later, Paul goes up and then he says the same thing, which in the book is a vision where he says, I see myself going and saying, hello, grandfather, whatever. They take that exact dialogue, and there's no vision in the movie, but that's exactly what he does. He goes up and says, hello, grandfather, or something to that effect. Kills him, so he gets his revenge for the Harkonnens taking out his family. You know, at least gets some kind of justice there. Essentially, Paul's like, I'm running the show. I'm going to be the emperor. Like, you need to secede to me. And this is when the emperor, or he says, like, you know, in their culture, you choose a fighter. We see it throughout the film that if you want to challenge someone, or if you want to take control, you challenge them. And you can have fighters, just like if you've seen Game of Thrones, there's the same kind of thing. Like,
yeah.
You know, the nobles
I've
don't
always
fight.
Hated it's, this plot device.
Really?
Well, yeah, you just pick someone else to fight for you. Like, that's... Well, what is that really established?
Well, that's why forces and emperors and kings would have their best fighters. Like, you're supposed to have the best forces. Like, that's just how they choose things. I don't know. It's never bothered me. I'm just like, this is how it is.
I just always thought it's a dumb plot device.
You train your best knights.
Lots of people do it. Yeah. Like, I'm not even bagging on this movie for doing or this book for doing it. It's a very old trope. I just always thought it was lame.
Gotcha. So anyway, he says, choose your fighter. And then Fade Ralpha says, I'm right here. I'm your Huckleberry. And I believe that's what he says, right? Coughs a couple times. I'm your Huckleberry.
Except there was an apostrophe in the middle of Huckleberry.
Huk Al Beret. There you go. I'm your Huk Al Beret. That might be like offensive. I don't know if we can say that. You know?
I don't know. It's just made up gibberish. It's what he's doing.
I don't know. But anyway, so he challenges him, and Fade Ralpha says, you know, I'm gonna fight, and the Emperor's like, you know, in his Christopher Walken way, is like, there he is, have fun. And
Walken really toned it down.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't
he
not
can't
complaining.
Not be walking,
yeah,
but
he can get very.
He tried his best. Like, it comes through because that literally is how he talks
for sure.
But it's not like every single word is so enunciated. You know, like it. You're right. He does tone it down. It's there for the Walken fans, but it's cool. I mean, it's cool to see him. When's the last time we saw Walken in like a major motion picture?
Yeah, I don't know.
Right? You just don't see him anymore. And so it's kind of cool to give him this part of the emperor of the whole deal. Gurney says, "Let me fight for you." And Paul is basically like, "I can't let you fight
for me. He doesn't like the trope either.
See?
He's like, I'm not picking someone to have a fight.
Well, see, there you go. It's not the trope. He fights for himself. See? But the emperor, you don't want to see. I mean, a walk-in can't do anything. So anyway, so Paul's like, I got to do the fighting here for myself. So he ends up facing off against Fade Ralpha. It's a knife fight. In the book, there's more to it where there's more sinister plots. There's like, Fade Ralpha has a poisoned blade, and he ends up poisoning Paul, so Paul is very slowed down, and then Paul is able to poison him, and then Fade Ralpha is like, you know, this is crazy, and Paul's like, yeah, you just poisoned me. I've only slowed you down to match me. You know, he's like, gotcha, because they don't suspect anyone would know what's going on. He says, like, oh, it's not detectable. But this, in the movie, it's more of just a fight. It's a, you know, knife fight between two people. I think the choreography is really good. It's intense. Like, I did not think Paul was going to die. It's one of those things where when you know the outcome, but it's still intense. I think that's a really good film or really good story when they can make you care. It's like when they do a prequel where you know who makes it
out. You know.
Yeah. But you're still like, oh, like, you know, I hope they...
Like Better Call Saul.
Yeah, that's a perfect example.
Better Call Saul.
Better Call Saul. So you know he's going to make it, but you're just like, oh, I care about this character. I want him to make it out. So you know Paul's going to make it, but man, it's intense. And it looks like Fade Ralpha has him dead to rights. He actually stabs him in the side, but we find out that because of Paul's visions, like, he's been able to plan it out to where the only way, or at least the best outcome he could see, was that if Fade Ralpha stabs him in the side, Paul's going to get close enough when he tries to finish him to stab him, you know, in the neck or in the chest with his own knife. So he gets injured, but not mortally wounded.
Wait, if you're having visions of what you're doing, that's just called making a plan.
Yeah, but his visions are real. Like, people can make plans, like, but like,
I envision myself stabbing you. Well, that's called a plan.
But it's like when
you made a plan, sir.
Doctor Strange, right? And it's like when he's like, I've done this millions of calculations, and this is the only one where we win, and he knows that Tony has to die in order to win. Spoilers for Avengers Endgame.
The
like,
literal most popular movie of all time.
Yeah. Yep. But he sees a million different ways, but the only way that they win is by Tony dying and sacrificing himself, and you know, Paul is able to see all these different visions, and there's different outcomes, and his best chance was he does have to get injured, but it gets him close enough. So like, he knows he can get injured without dying, and that will get him close enough. There's other movies that have done this thing, you know, where the good guy gets stabbed but not mortally wounded, and then just gets the other guy. So he gets him close enough. It's a really intense thing, and then he's like, well played, Paul. It's something, you know, whatever. He says something dramatic and then dies, and so that's it. So he takes over. Instead of killing the emperor, Paul is like, I'll let you live, and I'll let you have control of some planet. I don't think it was Getty Prime, but you know, he gives him some crap hole planet, whatever. Just
Getty Crackle.
he sends him to the planet, or he says, I will send you this planet so you can live out your days and rule and have your own thing going on, but I need to marry your daughter Irulan. And then, you know, they cut to Chani, and of course, and I know that you weren't really
Chani's like, but I kissed you once. That can't be a thing.
They slept together. They
because
were
I kissed you once
they were they slept
we to- slept together I got sand in my sandworm
in my AMC popcorn bucket.
Yes.
It's implied that they're in love and they were courting each other for a while, and there was more than just they kissed. But I get what you're saying. I totally get it. Again, in the book, it's 2 years. They have a child. Like, I think knowing the material, and I know it's not what they're showing us here, but like, if you know the material, at least I think you have it in your head. Like, they're a thing. They're established. So I can see where it's a little bit of shorthand here. But, you know, he tells her, I will always love you. And he knows eventually through the visions and what, you know, where the path is taking him, that he eventually is going to have to make this decision to, you know, get to his end goal. He's like, I'm going to have to be the emperor and to take control. I'm going to have to marry into another one of the noble houses, the most noble, the daughter of the emperor, the princess, will be my bride. And so it's heartbreaking for Chani. She's wearing this blue scarf that in their culture, and Villeneuve said that when they're in love, they wear this blue scarf. So once they're together and kiss and sleep together and have that moment, you see her wearing a blue scarf a lot. And I think she kind of takes it and throws it or whatever. You know, it's a heartbreaking moment because she obviously cares for him. And he says, no matter what, for the rest of my life, I will love you.
I'm just going to be over here with this other chick.
Now, we got to talk about the difference between the book and the movie. And I think what the movie did is really interesting. It gives you more to chew on. It gives that character more, because in the book, Chani is like, cool. Yeah, whatever Muad'Dib needs to do. Like, they're, and it's the 60s, you know, I think times were different. Writing female characters was different.
Sure.
Essentially, it was like, Paul is the prophet, Paul's the Muad'Dib, Paul's the, you know, Kizan Hazrak. Like, he's, Paul has been given all these things, but, like, everyone thinks Paul is the guy, right? And so he has his followers. Chani is not only his love interest and the mother of his child, but, like, she's a follower, and she believes in the religion. So in this movie, she, like, Stilgar, Bardem, is all, like, you know, as it was written. He's all, you know, he's a religious fanatic. Again, it's like, if people don't pick up on it, this is a commentary on religion. They see what they want to see. Every time he does, and why there's so many memes out there with Paul does anything, he's like, as it was written. Like, yeah. It's funny because, and like, it adds humor to the film, but it's also very real, where it's like, if people are looking for signs everywhere, yeah, they can, they make it's, one, and then they're like, that, it's a prophet. Yeah,
it's confirmation bias.
Yeah. So he's like, so there's, yeah, there's that meme everywhere with anything that Paul does. Paul, there's a meme where Paul turns a calculator upside down and writes boobies. And Stilgar goes, Lisan al Gaib. They're just making Paul do all these. He pulls out an ace and he goes, Lisan al, like he predicted his card. It's, the memes are freaking hilarious. You'd probably enjoy them more than the movie. Check out the memes. There's
that stands to reason. Right? Yeah.
Twitter on Twitter. Dune shit posting is the account. Go check it out. So you know, Chani run, you know, she busts out of there. She's like, I'm out of here. This is BS. And so it's very different. In the movie, Paul says to Chani and to the people in charge or whatever, he's like, Irulan will be my wife, but she's nothing to me. So he still, he never sleeps with Irulan in the books. He never wants to. It becomes a point of contention. Messiah takes place 12 years after Dune. I think the next movie kind of has to tell what happens in the 12 years. I just don't know that they'll jump 12 years ahead and have the whole thing basically be like this political intrigue. Like, I kind of feel like...
Like, I feel like, and I know this isn't what they're going to do, but what they should do, if that book is as you describe it, which I don't know why you would lie to me, that should be the TV show. Right,
that's true. Like, the 12 years make that a TV
like
show.
Make that the TV show.
And you got to get the people, which would be very hard.
Right.
For, I mean, this.
But
cast,
if there's not as much if there's not as many effects, and TV isn't slumming it like it used to be, and like make it like do a turn into a season or two of television because there's not as much visually stimulating things to look at, and then when you get past that, go back to the action stuff on the big screen.
I would love nothing more. I love the books. I love these movies. I would love it if they did that, seriously. But if you look at shows like other HBO shows, The Last of Us, which is the adaptation of the masterpiece, one of the best game series out there, season two is coming up, and it's Isabella Mirsad, the one that was Dora that I told you in the group. For the people that haven't listened to that episode, Dora the Explorer, the movie that has no right to be as good as it is, it's written by James Bobbin, which if you can see the poster behind Tom, the guy that directed the new Muppet movie, James Bobbin, and he was part of Flight of the Conchords, like that troupe of the New Zealander comedy guys. He directed and wrote Dora the Explorer, and it's fantastic. And Isabella Mirsad, who went by a different name at the time, is Dora, and we didn't realize that with the name change and everything. And she was the best part of Madam Web, we said. I mean, there wasn't a lot to like, but her and Adam Scott were there, and they knew what they were doing, and they were good in it. And she's going to be Hawk Girl in James Gunn's DC Universe, and she is going to be one of the characters, Dina, I think, in The Last of Us Part 2. So that was a long way of saying that when HBO makes these shows, they're filming for months, and you've got Pedro Pascal and these big actors that, like, they're doing movies. They're hot commodities in the film world. And so to do a project that takes months and months of filming, like, they're going to do it right. And this movie is comprised of a cast of the hottest actors right now, right? Like,
yeah,
I mean,
for sure.
Seriously, you have Timothy Chalamet.
I saw a headline that I wanted to just punch in the dick.
What was that?
Where it was like, Dune 2 launches career of generation of movie stars, and I'm like, these people are already movie stars. Florence Pugh, already a movie star. Timothy Chalamet, already a movie star. Zendaya, already a movie star. Batista, already a movie star. I'm like, no.
Stellan Skarsgård, up and coming.
Okay, that one maybe.
No,
I don't know.
That's
but,
the dad. That's the
oh, that's
dad.
The dad. I thought, no, not that. Yeah, awesome. But like Austin Butler already. Yeah. Like, yeah, I'm just like, no, that's not.
That
true.
Is the dad, right? Stellan Skarsgård. I don't want to mix up. There's Alexander, Bill. So that's one that we're like, they gave him the name.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm sick of writing all these characters, you know, the little O's over the letters and stuff. He's like, Bill. Bill Skarsgård. But no, that obviously that article's ridiculous. That's written by AI or something where they're like, look at all the actors that are really good in this movie. Write me an article. And they're like, look at this movie made this cast. So he says, I'm gonna marry Irulan. But in the book, again, he sleeps with Chani. Irulan actually is part of a conspiracy against Paul, which is one of the plot points of Messiah that we'll see, or, you know, if he adapts it faithfully. And Irulan is poisoning Chani with a contraceptive so she cannot bear him an heir. So that's, you know, kind of one of the big plot points of Messiah. I don't know if that's bad to say. Like, that's...
Yeah.
Obviously, the book's really old. I don't, you know, and I don't know if he will adapt it like that, but Irulan is not happy because it's been 12 years. She wants a child, and Paul has never even slept with her, won't give her a child. He does the deal with the emperor, you know, he convinces him. The reverend mother is like, this is crazy. We should have never let you get this far, or whatever he has. And he uses the voice, you know, and says silence and knocks her back in her chair. So I don't know if you realize this, but only the Bene Gesserit are the ones that are supposed to be able to use the voice. But Lady Jessica has trained Paul, and for a male to use the voice is very unusual.
The voice was dumb.
Well, it's part of, I mean, that's a I just, huge I, part of Dune. It's
yeah,
just,
I just thought it sounded
dumb. The voice, like in the first one, remember, she uses it to like have the guards untie him. Like, she's has a kerchief in her mouth or whatever you call that. She's gagged, and Paul is able to use the voice, which normally men can't do that. And he got the bad guy to remove her gag. Then she used the voice to like really take him out or walk off this Thropter or whatever, and he dies. In the books, Paul is also trained as a Mentat, the human computer. This movie, Villeneuve said he wanted to focus more on the Bene Gesserit side of things, so they don't really go into Paul being a Mentat, but he does have that supreme intelligence and being able to calculate and everything. So he uses the voice, he takes control, and the movie really ends on Chani. And what I was getting at earlier was it's really interesting in the movie how in the book, Chani is just complacent. She's just there, and you know, whatever you want to do, Paul. But also Paul is like, I still love you. You're really going to be my queen, but just not in title. But in the movie, it gives her more agency. In the movie, Chani's like, this is ridiculous. I said from the beginning, our people should free our people. He's not a prophet. He's not a messiah. You know, he's a man, and you know, I love him, but like, he's not the prophet. I don't believe in all this old religion crap. You know, she represents the young people, which is a very obvious allegory of like young people now seeing through the BS of religion and control.
Yeah.
And I just think it's a really good modern take, and it gives that character agency so that when he comes around and does Messiah, however he's going to tell it, whether it's 12 years in between or fast forward to the future, which with this ending, I don't think it can be. I mean, I guess it could be 12 years later and Chani shows up 12 years older and like disturbs stuff, but like, that's completely new from the book, right? In the book, she's there with Paul for 12 years. So I think it's interesting that they gave Zendaya more to do, because I do think the character's kind of wasted if she's just like, sure, Paul, whatever.
You want to? Yeah, and you don't bring in an actress like her. And
to not, yeah.
Yeah.
So she's given something to do. She's very obviously heartbroken. She's angry. She knows this isn't right. And so I think the movie may be setting up that she is going to actually stop Paul. So I think this story may go a different direction, where instead of killing 61 billion, or maybe she fails and he does kill 61 billion. But what may happen is, since Chani's leaving, I think she may actually stop him sometime between now and Messiah. And if you notice, I don't know if you remember from the first movie, but Paul has a vision where he's in this gold armor and he's fighting the Sardaukar forces, and the visor comes down and it's Paul's face. He like swings around and has a knife in someone's neck and the visor comes down and it's him. That's a vision he has. In this movie, there's a parallel where Chani's fighting the Sardaukar as they try to take back control of the castle and fight the emperor or whatever, and she swings around and she's in the exact same position. So that's one of Paul's visions, where he saw it as being him, but now she's fulfilling that part of his visions. So I just think the character is going in a different direction. And so where Paul was supposed to be the Messiah and the prophet and save them all, I think that he's writing this story so Chani is the savior.
Gotcha.
And is going to stop Paul, and it's going to come down between these two people that love, say they always love each other, but they want two different things. And so I think that could make for a really interesting movie, rather than jumping to 12 years later and Paul killed everyone and rules the universe.
It's also, you know? I will say, it's weird though to have so faithfully adapted this book thus far and then make a change that significant.
Yeah.
That's a big pivot.
For sure. So I don't know, but I can't read it any other way that there's going to be some huge difference. I do want to, you're probably done.
Yeah, oh yeah, I've been done.
Real quick, I just want to add, because Matt Reedy took the time. He couldn't be on the podcast because we're recording at a strange time. But he said, I liked the movie. I just didn't love it. So I wanted to kind of give the middle ground. This is actually perfect. He's right in the middle. Loves the books. Liked the movie. He just didn't love it. I'm all for making changes to the source material as long as it makes sense. To compare against other movies based on my favorite books, I had no problem with the changes in Lord of the Rings, but I didn't care for the changes made to Hitchhiker's Guide. I think this movie kind of falls in between. The two biggest issues I have are the shortened timeline, like I talked about, it doesn't flash forward 2 years, and all the fallout that comes from that decision, and they made Chani a skeptic for the entire movie. I actually liked that notion at first to give her more dimension and kind of addresses the white savior issue. The problem was that in the end, she was wrong. Paul ended up being pretty much exactly what he was prophesized, so whether or not she believed, he was the one that led her people to victory, and what looked like her getting mad about Paul's proposal was silly. She's smart enough to know that it's just a power play and has nothing to do with the love or romantic reasons. So he took it the other way, is that she should have kind of, based on him knowing the book, that she should have kind of went in line. But I get it. I just think that this is a more modern take to where, like, you don't betray the people you love. But I also see this as, like, this is a very... Leto did the same thing, right? With Jessica. He didn't marry her.
This is a very common thing in this world.
Right, in this world, exactly. Not a deal breaker, but still an odd way to end the movie. Maybe they thought it would have made her seem subservient if she would have sided with Paul. And back to the shortened timeline, I just think the story did a disservice. When I sat in on the podcast for Dune Part 1, I mentioned that they ended the story too soon, not to be an armchair director, but I would have ended Part 1 after Paul does his first worm ride and gains total acceptance. Then Part 2 would take place in its time and show how he amasses his army, plus you would have lost all that collateral damage that comes with hurting everything. Kid Alia, the little sister, baby Leto, the child that dies, Hawit, that's another thing that Stephen McKinley Henderson, who was great in the first one, he filmed for Part 2. He's supposed to be Baron Harkonnen captures him and is poisoning him and has the antidote, and only they can keep him alive. So he ends up being the mentat in helping the Harkonnens with their stuff, and they just completely cut him out of this one. Villeneuve spent his time on Southern Arrakis fundamentalist thing, which I think was kind of interesting, and the bit at the very end seemed extremely rushed. I honestly laughed as soon as the Great Houses refused to acknowledge Paul's rule. They show all these Fremen running into empty spaceships and taking off to kill a billion people. Slow it down, guys. A jihad can wait a few days. Do you even want to know where you're going? Remember the end credits scene of Finding Nemo, where the fish escape the dentist's office? It shows them floating in plastic bags on the ocean, and one of them says, "Now what?" I wanted something just like that. The end credits of Dune, just showing Fedekin soldiers in spaceships hovering above Arrakis, shrugging their shoulders, wondering what to do next. The funny thing is, Paul now owns all spice production and therefore controls the spacing guild. Why should he even give a shit? The greatest houses won't bend the knee. All he has to do is cut off their spice deliveries and they will kiss his ass. It's true. They can't travel without it.
So. Yeah.
But I think that was kind of like, in hindsight, like they called his bluff and then he's like, well, good luck. And now he's the emperor. So I think now they have no choice. Like they literally will have to.
Yeah.
Again, I'm way overthinking this. I bet after repeat viewings, I'll come to enjoy the movie. And even as it is, there was a lot I enjoyed. Like I mentioned, Austin Butler basically stole the show. Complete opposite, right? Isn't that interesting? And absolutely loved the scenes of Getty Prime. The black sun atmosphere effect was so cool, especially the inkblot fireworks. That was really cool too. Honestly, casting across the board for these two movies was great. If they make Dune Messiah and it becomes a hit and they go to the other books, that's going to be a good paycheck for Jason Momoa when they bring Duncan Idaho back. Spoilers. So even though he couldn't be on this episode, he was on our part one, and I'm glad that we could get some insight from
absolutely
him. He's been a fan of the books longer than me.
Loves the books, so absolutely. So
I loved it. I love the books.
I know I'm the odd man out. Movie. Like, I acknowledge that.
And to each their own. It surprises me. I just, with your background and the other movies you like, I don't get it, but I mean.
It just, like I said, did nothing for me. Yeah. So, but I guess let's go around the table and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Kevin. You can follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And this is Tom. You can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. You can find the show online at facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, and of course, don't forget our Patreon. So that's it for this one. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, Earl uses Burt's pipe bombs. Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice because we already warned you. Better watch out. It's going to ruin the plot.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.